I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek, the talk show about items of interest to the geeks of the world and you. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. Hello, Tom Merritt.
Well, hello, Scott Johnson.
Hi. It's good to be here. How are you?
It's great to be here.
Yeah.
I am. I'm enjoying our old school way of doing this show now. I know some, you know, 10 or 12 folks miss listening to it live, but the rest of you don't even notice. So it's great. And it's a nostalgic feel.
It is. We both, you and I, you know, were podcasting in the early 2000s. Late 04, 05 years.
And gosh, the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's pretty weird to think it was in the first part of that decade. And and because of that,
we're almost into the 20s, Scott.
I know. I don't like it.
We can go back to saying decades by their number again.
Yeah. I mean, I'd try to compare it to other decade changes. And it's weird because the difference between the 80s and 90s didn't feel as significant to me at the time I was going through it. Or maybe it just didn't seem like it went very fast. It seemed like a nice
blends,
long time.
Right? It's not like January 1st, 1990. Suddenly everyone's like, okay, put away the pastels, bring the hair down. Let's start wearing flannel, everyone. It's 1990 here.
Right, right. It didn't happen. But then this thing, these two decades, I don't know. It just feels like a different kind of.
I feel like you always need two decades to start to understand the defining characteristics of a previous decade.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it wasn't until recently that we really started to look at the 90s as being 90s-ish. Like I remember in the 2000s thinking like, well, the 90s don't seem that weird. Mm-hmm. But now we've started to, and I bet in the next 5 years or so, the 2000s will start to feel like, oh, that's back when everybody wore a hoodie and you had a click wheel iPod and, you know, like the stereotypes will start to emerge.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember it was the 80s that the 50s and 60s started to seem weird or interesting. And the 70s just seemed like, oh, that's that decade we left. It's no big deal. But then the 70s took on its own life in the 90s. So, yeah, I think Tom's on to something. Tom, you're on to something.
I followed this very closely.
Yeah, very good. Nice job. Well, let's see if you're on to these things here. Oh, gosh dang it. Perfect transition, and I screwed it up.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom, what happened since we last talked about these things?
So many things. And let me just tell you right now, they were all submitted by Jeff Rose.
Oh, my gosh. That guy's a monster. He's great.
He's amazing. Yeah. And I do not look at who submitted them when I go and pick them. Mm-hmm. I look at the interest of the topic and I look at the votes.
Right.
Those are the two things I look at. And, you know, just kind of happened. So step it up, other people. You know, let's go.
People that aren't Jeff
but
Rose.
Our first one came that California enacted a law that stops middle school from starting before 8 a.m.
Whoa.
And requires high schools to wait until 8:30 a.m.
Why now? How come we're? Yeah, hold on a second. This sucks. I go back in time and apply this retroactively, please. I was up too early every day. Lame.
I was going to get to that.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
When I was in school, these times would have been early. We didn't start first period till like maybe 8:55 or something, but usually like 9 o'clock.
We were like 7:30 or something.
What, really?
Yeah, it was early here. Part of it was we have tons of kids and B days and A days. And like there's a child population Utah thing that probably contributed to the earlier
too many
starts.
Kids. The big schools and they had to adapt.
They also came up with like a year-round school here as well, which I know is in other places now, but year-round schools.
I found this is my schedule from, I believe, junior high.
What? You had that handy?
I had social studies started at 8:48 a.m.
Oh, my Lord. Okay, keep going. This is amazing to me.
Anyway, so now the law in California is you can't start middle school before 8, and you can't start high school before 8:30. Schools, there's some exceptions. Rural schools can get an exception. Schools with a collective bargaining agreement that prohibits this from happening. until the bargaining agreement expires, can get out of it. But most schools will have until July 1st, 2022 to come into compliance. And this is because folks at the American Academy of Pediatrics, among others, have argued that early start times threaten the sleep of children and put their health at risk. Teenagers generally have a hard time falling asleep before 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. You can say what you want to them. Mm-hmm. It's just a biological fact, and need between 8.5 and 9.5 hours of sleep. So if they can't fall asleep till 11, and they have to get up at 7 a.m. for school, well, then that's 8 hours. That's just shy of what they need. 3-year study of 9,000 high school students found academic performance improved with start times of 8:35 a.m. or later. So they've looked at this and said, yeah, once we delayed the time, suddenly just across the board, things got better.
Hmm. Only a few decades late, guys. Thanks. We appreciate it for, you know, thinking of us. And
I was going to say, but when I was a kid, school didn't start at 8 a.m. in middle school.
Yeah, you can say.
And it certainly didn't start at 8:30 a.m. in high school. I'm pretty sure in high school it was close to 9 as well.
That's awesome.
We had a zero period, mm-hmm. which would start earlier, but this doesn't affect that. Early, like early PE or early stuff that is voluntary, mm-hmm. that can still start earlier. It's mm-hmm. only like the official start of school that has to stay later. And apparently the changes, the drift, didn't happen until in the 80s, and it was because of both parents working. Mm. So, you know, when I was a kid, even when both my parents were working, which they always weren't, but even when they were, you know, my dad had a commute of 5 to 10 minutes.
Right.
So it was not a big deal to be like, oh, I'm going to drop you off for school and then head to work and be there by 9. It was fine. Mm-hmm. Now people have commutes that are, you know, an hour, and they want to drop their kids off at 7 a.m. because that's when they're on their way into work.
Right.
So
that could disrupt that a little.
One of the negatives of this law is that California schools aren't equipped to deal with taking care of kids before school starts. And you may just have a bunch of parents dumping off their kids like, I got to go to work. Here you go. Mm-hmm. Knock yourselves out. And that could cost money. It could cause issues, you know, disobedience, et cetera.
Sure. So it has some knock-on effects perhaps, but we'll see how it goes. Lucky kids though, compared to me anyway, because this never worked for me.
So well, yes and no. Like if your parent makes you get up anyway, because they have to go to work and you're riding with them, you're not taking a bus or something.
That's worse even.
It might kind of suck for you.
Yeah, that's even worse, because then you're hanging around school and stuff long before any of your friends get there, and that's lame.
Yeah.
Or maybe all their friends will have a problem because their parents all don't want to do it. I don't know. But
I don't know why, but I also have my fall semester 1989 University of Illinois grade report here.
How'd you do?
Well, I got an A in astronomy, B in history, A in psychology, A in Russian, and an A in kinesiology.
None of this shocks me. Your high grades are expected.
I got a B in history. That was Western civilization.
Oh, you were only good at Eurasian studies.
I was really good at English history.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
As soon as you included the other ones, though, I was like, eh.
Those other Western countries, man, it gets really complicated. Good. I get it.
Yeah. All right. The Internet Archive has released 2,500 MS-DOS games, including Vorterra, Spooky Kooky Monster Maker, Princess Maker 2, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, and the classic 1992 Alone in the Dark. Mm. And there's also Mr. Blobby, based on the BBC TV show character Mr. Blobby from the TV show Noel's House Party. As usual with the archive, when they put these things up, they make them playable at archive.org.
Yeah. So this came up on one of my game shows this week, and one of the hosts, Bo Schwartz, cannot stop playing these things. There are some people out there with incredible amounts of MS-DOS nostalgia, and the fact that these things are showing up and playable in a browser on the Internet Archive is super exciting. I still don't 100% understand the legality of this stuff. I know that their goal, as always at archive.org, is to preserve the Internet and content and digital property for as long as we can preserve it. And so I really like why they do it, but I don't understand how they, like Alone in the Dark is still an IP owned by a company. They still make games for that. They still, you know.
A lot of times archive.org will get permission.
Interesting.
Where permission might not be given otherwise, because they are a library. Okay. They are considered a library, and they're a nonprofit. Mm. And so sometimes they can just go to the company that owns the rights and say, hey, you know, in the interest of preservation, we want to make these available. We'll keep them from being copied and all of that sort of thing. Or we won't make it easy for them to be copied. But sometimes they'll get around it that way. I think they also have some protection as a library to making stuff available. So that I'm sure that's part of it too.
I have a mini forecast. There'll come a day in our lifetime where the Internet Archive and those who founded it and run it will get a Nobel Peace Prize for something. Mark my words.
Yeah. I mean, they'll get a prize. I don't know if the Nobel is really the right one.
But they'll get something that recognizes.
I'm definitely with you that they will win some sort of like, I don't know, what's the big literary prize you always see on.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name. I think I know what you
mean. I'm not talking about like Booker Prize or something like that, but isn't there a library-oriented prize?
Yeah, something a lot of people get it for like, oh, they've found the only remaining copies of something and restored them and... You know, like there's always somebody somewhere is always deserving this thing for doing something cool in the behind the scenes to preserve content. And I think that they deserve it.
Anyway, yeah, I think you're right. I think they will get some kind of recognition for their service to humanity.
That would be good.
But let me tell you, Alone in the Dark, that does take me back.
Dude, that game legit scared me. And I looked at it here when it, you know, this hit this weekend. It looks terrible. Looks terrible.
It's not scary at all. No. Like it, and I say that feeling exactly the same way. Like I used to feel like, I don't know, this game is a little too scary. Mm-hmm. And now I look at it, I'm like, why did it ever scare me? But this was good graphics.
For the time, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what is realistic to you is all in your head. Mm-hmm. It's what you'll accept. It's what you'll forgive. Mm-hmm. And at the time, looking at this, we're like, wow, I can imagine this all being real.
There's also a pretty, you could make a pretty good argument that the game is responsible for starting an entire genre known as survival horror that didn't exist before that game. Things like Resident Evil, things like Silent Hill, countless others. I don't know that those, certainly maybe those things kind of sprout out on their own, but this game laid a lot of groundwork. And in Resident Evil's case, they kind of copied the exact format of it, these high angles in rooms and this sort of pseudo 3D thing happening and all that. I mean, it wasn't that long after this series had made its mark. So you're going to find that and a bunch of others. Like I was playing, what was I playing? Oh, Prince of Persia a little bit. I forgot you. It's not too far to fall without getting hurt. So you got to watch it in that game. But yeah, there's a treasure trove, 2,500 new ones added. So go check it out.
Speaking of old stuff,
yeah.
Back in 1502, Leonardo da Vinci, know him?
Yeah, he's a dude what made lots of ceilings and helicopters before they were a thing. And then a lady who looked at you funny. That's his deal.
Yeah, it's kind of small. The lady. I just saw it in August.
Yeah.
It's all right. Leonardo da Vinci drew up designs for a bridge to connect Istanbul to Galata. If it had been built, it would have been the world's longest bridge at the time. It's 790 feet. The design used only the pressed bow, parabolic curve, and keystone arch.
Wow.
So you were basically relying on gravity. The design was rejected, but a team of MIT engineers has used a 3D printer to create a 1-500 scale model. They didn't build the whole 790-foot bridge, but at scale, they built the bridge with only gravity to hold it together, and it held.
Whoa.
Well done, Da Vinci.
Jeez.
And shame on you for doubting him, Sultan Bayezid II, who turned down the design.
Well, this happened a lot with Da Vinci. He had all sorts of designs, both ones that he just wouldn't finish because he just got tired of it or whatever. So many unfinished works, both art and structural. But then there were always people hiring him for stuff, and it seemed too far out there, and then they would bail at the last second. But here we go again. That dude was smart, man.
Every time you see an article on the internet and you think, well, that's stupid, that'll never work, you are being like Sultan Bayezid II to a potential Leonardo da Vinci.
Sultan Bayezid II, may your name forever be filled with shame because you didn't approve the bridge.
But I love that, like, more than 500 years later, we use a 3D printer to go, huh? No, he was right. This totally would work. And this had been debated whether this particular design would work or not over the centuries. Mm-hmm. Some people thought it would. Some people like, nah, I think it's got a weakness. But nobody could try it out until 3D printers came along and made it super easy. I mean, I guess somebody could have carved some blocks. But 3D printers made it so that you could be like, you know what I've been meaning to get around to? Trying out that Da Vinci bridge design.
Yeah. It reminds me, one of the things I love about Da Vinci and I love about people like him is they always feel like they're just one dude in 100 years that's like this. Somebody who just blows away all expectation or is such a beyond his years sort of genius that, you know, his name will be known for all time because you just can't help it. It was just too big of a deal for when he lived. Had he lived today, it wouldn't have been as big a deal. A lot of things have happened that he would have just sort of come late to it. But,
and he was literally a Renaissance man.
Yeah, truly the only, honestly, maybe the only Renaissance man, other than people that were around him, I suppose. They were also
Renaissance.
It's
hard to compare him now because you might be like, oh, it's like Steve Jobs, except, well, Steve Jobs was a businessman. Mm-hmm. He was good at making other people come up with good designs. He didn't actually design anything himself.
Right.
Oh, he's always like Elon Musk. Kind of the same thing. Elon Musk has some engineering expertise, but he doesn't usually do it, right? Mm-hmm. It's him coordinating it. Oh, what about Yves Bihar? Well, Yves Bihar is designing the look of things, not how they work. Da Vinci was something you just don't see anymore. He did it all. Mm-hmm. He painted, he engineered, he built. In a time when we didn't have scale, so he had to. I think we sometimes over, like, why aren't there people like him anymore? It's like, well, because we don't need to. We actually can work at scale now. And distributing labor has turned out to be very profitable for the world. And it has created a better world for all of us. But it means you don't get a Da Vinci as easy.
I wonder if we have one today that we will one day, or our, you know, those who come after us will one day look back and go, okay, he was the Da Vinci of that time. And it's hard for me to think of who.
It's hard, though, because, like I said, Da Vinci had to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, not everybody can do all this stuff, and that's what's special about Da Vinci. But if there is someone as talented as Da Vinci today, they don't need to do it all.
Right.
So they'll get really good at some aspects of it. And yeah, we definitely have people who are good at more than one thing and dabble and show that they're good in those multiple things.
Hard.
I don't know why, but Jeremy Renner comes to mind because he's really good at real estate and acting.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably not the best example, but
yeah.
You know, there are those aspects of stuff. Or Tom Cruise who learns to do the stunts that he does. People call him a Renaissance man because of that.
Yeah.
But you're not forced to have to do all the things Da Vinci did. So I think it's more rare to see it emerge.
Yeah, the collective iteration has put us in a place where we just don't need a guy like that, or it's just less needful anyway because everybody can. Oh man, there's so many facets of what made him special that we have now integrated into life to the point that anybody could be really. You could, you know, a guy that loves his job down at the gas station could do a cool thing on the weekend that in the Renaissance period would have made him the most famous human being on the planet. Like that's just
the
way iterative.
The reason entertainment probably comes to mind, you know, both my examples were actors, is because acting gives people the flexibility to try something else. And whereas becoming an engineer, that side of Da Vinci stuff, like, you don't really need to do anything else. You get paid well and it sucks up all your time.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. Mm. Well, good luck, whoever it might be. Our next thing, I bet Walt Disney gets talked about a lot.
It's not that actors don't get paid well. It's almost like they get paid too well.
Sure. That's a good point.
Yeah, so they can dabble with other stuff.
Yeah.
Warp speed in Star Trek, often described as the speed of light for warp factor one, and then multiples of that. There are lots of different definitions of it in the universe, but according to the Star Trek Technical Manual published in 1991, warp factor 9.9 would be 2,000 times the speed of light. Now, that seems plenty fast until you actually start to use real distances between things in space, as former NASA and current JAXA scientist James O'Donohue did. At maximum warp, 9.9,
right,
it would take 18 hours to reach Proxima Centauri, the nearest star.
Okay. Wow.
A trip across the galaxy would take 96 years, and a transwarp voyage across the galaxy Transwarp is where you go 8,323 times the speed of light, would take 24 years.
Wow. Okay, so I think I heard some context of this in with Star Trek. Somebody was talking about this in a dinner I was at, and they said,
"Oh yeah."
They said, "Did you hear that? It turns out Voyager could have gotten home in like a week because they figured out that minimum, maximum warp, something, something." I wonder if this was what they were referring to, because we were getting into this sort of conversation about, you know, why Star Trek had to have stuff be so far away. And in the case of Voyager,
well,
which everybody was watching.
That's so funny, because I looked at this and immediately thought, okay, the point of James O'Donohue was to show just how far things are apart,
right,
in space.
Right.
And he was saying even at 2,000 times the speed of light, it would take 18 hours to reach Proxima Centauri.
Right.
And that's the closest star. Imagine how long it's going to take to reach the other star. 96 years to cross the galaxy.
Right.
But as soon as he said 96 years to cross the galaxy at warp 9.9, I started to think, well, didn't Voyager think it was going to take like 70 some years,
yeah,
to get home?
Yeah, they did.
And they were going not entirely across the galaxy, but from a far part of the Delta Quadrant to a far part of the Alpha Quadrant.
Right.
So I'm like, well, that sounds about right then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
I guess
96
so.
Years to cross the whole galaxy, 70 some years to cross a large part of the galaxy seems proportionate.
It does to me, especially based on this particular information from this scientist. I think the guys I was talking to were crazy, because there's no way it turns it into a week. I'm like, you guys, no. I think you got that wrong. But I had no basis for this. I had no way to argue it, so I didn't know what to say.
Yeah, yeah.
But now I do.
Well, I mean,
now I can show this and I can say, well, hold on a second. Let's look.
That's funny, because we both busted some FUD from different directions. You were like, wait a minute, those guys are silly. This bears out that Voyager was right. They needed transwarp to make that to make that trip faster.
Right.
Which is, you know, that was what they were always after, was that transwarp corridor, right?
Yep.
And I looked at it as like James O'Donohue's trying to make it sound like space travel is really slow at warp speed, but it sounds like it's about right. Like,
yeah.
Usually the Enterprise was taking several days to go from one point to another. It wasn't
always, yeah,
going warp 9.9 either, but
sometimes months, I mean, they would say, you know, the captain's log, we've been flying at high speed or whatever for 24.3 days, and we are almost
to Deep Space Five. It's a 3-day trip,
right?
You know,
right. I think they had that right, or pretty close to right. And I think I'll bet you, I could be totally wrong about this, but I'll bet throughout all of the history of Star Trek, whenever this sort of stuff was bandied around in the techno babble, they did some work to try to be close, because they don't want that kind of scrutiny or people later on going, "Boy, did you have that wrong?" Like they're trying to portray like a utopian ideal of us reaching a technical pinnacle and then reaching out into the stars the way that Star Trek depicts. So it's nice to think that they maybe, you know, did their homework or tried to work on the math a little.
I mean, in the original series, they didn't.
No,
always.
Not so much. Right.
There are lots of corners cut, but you're right. Like, definitely in the modern times, you had Rick Sternbach, you had Michael and Denise Okuda, that were the technical advisors, to the Next Generation and shows after that. And they were very, very much trying to figure out the reality behind it, or if they were breaking rules of reality, coming up with, you know, plausible new technologies that would allow them to do so.
The idea of Proxima Centauri only being 18 hours away is impressive to me. It seems like nothing to me. And I realize it's not, and 9.9 is a thing is only figurative. we don't know how we'd ever do it. But if we did 18 hours, so what? That's about how long it took me to get to Japan. So
yeah, right.
Yeah.
It takes like 16 hours to go LA to Sydney, Australia.
Yeah,
so sure.
Yeah, why not?
I get to Proxima Centauri in that same amount.
I don't think that's fast. That's not so bad. Plus you're getting beamed on. It's not like you had to wait in line or do the whole TSA thing.
I definitely would like to have a lay flat bed for that trip to Proxima Centauri.
Well, wouldn't we all?
I mean, those are expensive though.
They are. Do it like the, here's what I want. In Fifth Element, Bruce Willis, when he gets on this cruise ship, in order to go as far as they're going, they just insert them into little bed tubes, and then they put everybody to sleep. They cryogenically just stop you from, you know, being awake for however long it takes. Mm-hmm. I'm totally fine with that. Like,
I would like that for my trip to Sydney.
Yes. Yes. That's my point. Even
yes.
Like, if just hell, there's trips to Vegas. I would just like my car to drive without me and put me in cryogenic sleep. I just want to go to sleep and then wake up suddenly, like an operation or something. You just don't remember anything, and it's all just time
you
gone.
Could have your dentistry done during the trip.
Yes. Oh, we've solved all the world's problems now.
Finally.
Yeah. Nice job.
You're welcome, world. Also, finally, Roku announced that Apple is launching an Apple TV app. In fact, has launched an Apple TV app for most Rokus. The app lets you access your purchased or rented TV shows and movies, as well as programs from Apple TV channels like HBO or CBS All Access. This doesn't mean you get your apps, though. Mm. So Apple TV channels means in the Apple TV app on the Apple TV mm-hmm. device, mm-hmm. you've subscribed to the HBO, CBS All Access, Showtime, Stars, etc.
Right.
If you subscribe to HBO through the app, the HBO app on the Apple TV, you don't show up on your
Roku. Apple TV, the service you get and all that comes with it.
And anything you subscribe through the Apple TV service.
Right.
And then when Apple TV Plus shows up on November 1st for $5 a month, that will show up too. But let me tell you, it is freaky to be using your Roku and click an Apple TV app button and have the Apple logo show up. And it's like, wait, did I accidentally switch to my Apple TV? Yeah. Like it's just weird because then the interface shows up and anything that you've been watching that is available through. So most of my movies, right? I got Movies Anywhere connected to Apple TV. All of those show up and it's like you're looking at an Apple TV.
That's really is weird. It's weird because we get this a little bit from Microsoft. You know, like they put their services on competing devices. It used to be you'd never see that, and that's all changed. Mm. We don't even think about it now. This is like the first time I've ever seen Apple do something sort of like that.
But Apple Music is on Android.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I guess there's an
example.
And
iTunes came to Windows.
That's true. Safari was on Windows for a while, that sort of thing. Yeah. I bet they're a little, whatever. I have Safari thoughts. But this is interesting because I think that they also have a lot at stake here. This needs to be a universally liked thing. It needs to be like HBO where people can get it regardless of their devotion to whatever platform, because I think the kind of money they're spending on an annual basis and the kind of return they need is going to require that. So it makes sense to me.
Well, Apple, if people don't know, Daily Tech News Show talks about this all the time. Apple is trying to move from being a device revenue company to a service revenue company. In other words, they used to make their money off the devices. So they'd give away stuff for free on the devices with the hope that you'd buy the devices because that's where they made their money.
Right.
Now they're moving to be a services-oriented company where it's not like they're going to give away their devices, don't get me wrong, but they know that the incremental revenue that's going to keep powering the company will come from things like Apple Music and Apple TV Plus. And if you're going to have services that catch on, you're going to have to put those services on non-Apple devices if you want to get it in front of enough people to make your service worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's sensible. I don't think here's the thing. I don't think you're going to see this on Amazon Fire stuff.
On the Fire TV?
Yeah. I don't think so.
I wouldn't say you won't. But it's unlikely. It's going to take some peace in our time kind of negotiations. And Amazon's going to have to get something for that. Video mm-hmm. does show up on Apple TV and iOS devices, mm-hmm. Which was a big deal. So that's why I say, like, never say never. Maybe they'll figure out a way to do that.
Maybe how they did that, they do with that again, whatever they had to do to appease that deal. I don't know.
They started selling Apple stuff on the Amazon store.
I didn't realize that was the deal.
That drove out a bunch of third-party sellers and made them all mad. That happened all at the same time.
Quid pro quo going on there.
There might have been some quids proing some quos. But in this case, it was on the up. That's fine. There was nothing illegal about that kind of quid pro quo.
Well, we'll see. Coming soon, Apple Plus TV. We'll see how it plays on your Roku and how the service is in general. Soon enough. Big thanks to all our submitters on subreddit. Now, today, as Tom mentioned, we only really had the one, but man, did he deliver. So huge thanks to Jeff Rose.
And we thank everybody who submits, even if we don't use your stuff. It's great to see that stuff in there and all the people who are voting and stuff. So get over there, currentgeek.reddit.com.
Please do. Now this. Rolling, 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 rolling. Time for us to play a little bit of the old Rolling. Well, keep on rolling. That's what I meant to say. Keep on rolling. It's a segment called Keep on Rolling, where Tom reads Scott a passage from French literary critic Roland Barthes' seminal work, Mythologies. Tom, what do we have this week? Yeah, mythology. Wee wee poo poo.
All right. Are you ready for the passage? This has been working. Taking smaller quotes. These are not so much passages as quotes now.
I agree.
But here is the quote this week, Scott, from Roland Barthes.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural work done in the past by gods and epic sagas is now done by laundry detergent commercials and comic strip character.
Whoa. Okay, let me wrap my head around it. What he's saying is, cultural work done in the past by gods and epic sagas.
So like the Iliad and the Odyssey, the mythology of Zeus,
right?
The tales of all of that. That is now the province of laundry detergent commercials and comic strip characters.
I mean, it's such a narrow grouping, but I think I agree with him. But it's much larger than that. It's now the place of a guy at home with a camera and a YouTube account. Like we're in a whole new.
Oh my gosh, Roland Barthes, what he would make of YouTube?
Oh, can you even imagine? Like or social media for that matter. Like that's always a fun brain experiment to try to think what somebody would do with Twitter, some historical dude. But in this case, I think he's right, and he was right about the fringes of it, but I think it's turned into everything. Like,
knowing a little bit about Barthes, behind this quote, I think what he's saying is the tales of the gods, the epic sagas, were meant to sort of propagandize people, kind of pacify them into believing a certain thing about the universe that was beneficial to the ruling classes. That's the kind of stuff Barthes would say.
Interesting.
Right? And so he's saying laundry detergent commercials and comic strip characters are doing the same thing. They're putting out this message of the world works like this, and you should do this to work in it. You, the woman watching this laundry detergent commercial, which is what it was in the time that he was writing, should worry about these troubles of your clothing and buy this laundry detergent and it will make you happy.
Yeah.
The same way that the tales of the gods were sort of like keeping people in line.
Right.
So I'm not sure if he would class YouTube stuff in the same way or if he would. I could see it both ways. On the one hand, he may say, well, it's too diverse. On the other hand, this whole situation where the algorithm is working.
Right.
I think he definitely come down on the side of well, the algorithm certainly is playing that.
I mean, we literally call these people influencers. I wonder how that would land on him.
Yeah, right.
You know, I don't know. That's super interesting. I love this segment. This is like, I wasn't sure about it in the beginning because I just didn't know the dude and didn't know what was going to go on, but I love it now. I love it.
I'm so glad that we've brought in some post-structuralist semiotics into our show.
Well, you deserve the credit. I'll tell you who else deserves the credit. It's you people at home who support us at Patreon. We need you, and we thank you for those who do. Please head over if you haven't and check it out. There's great stuff, including original art every month in the mail. There's no other way to get it. So go to patreon.com/currentgeek. That's patreon.com/currentgeek and be a part of it today.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
Time for forecast, a little segment based on an old show we used to do where we predicted the future. And today, I have a prediction.
Da-da!
Brr-brr. Now, I don't know if you saw this. Or it's good. Oh, that's our best thing of all time this week.
You're moving on to the next segment already.
All right. So here's the deal. So in the last, I don't know, week or something, a company released a kind of capsulized disintegratable form of alcohol that, and there've been attempts at this before, but this appears to be like, I don't know, some next level stuff that you put in some water and now you suddenly have your favorite whiskey, your favorite whatever you want to drink. And it got me to thinking, as that stuff gets better and better, that we will soon have, I don't know what soon means, let's say 20 years or something, nearly everything we like in drink form will come in some sort of capsule that we can mix with water, and it will be indistinguishable from the real thing. So if you want cinnamon Coke, you'll get a little capsule, put it in the thing, and suddenly you've got a fizzy exact replica of that. And this, by the way, could lead to other food things that could happen. this will be interesting to see Tom's response because his dad was a food scientist. So I knew that going into this as I typed this. But it feels like at least on the drink level, you want your orange juice, you want your cranberry, you want whatever, your iced tea. These little things are going to come in these packets. You're going to pop it in and boom, and you're going to have the important part here is a indistinguishable version of that drink, not some crappy, aftertasty, bad version of it. I think that's coming.
Yeah. What's interesting is that powdered alcohol goes back to 1966. That's when Sato Foods invented it and began selling a high-content alcohol powder called Alcock, which they would definitely not name it that now.
No, probably not. I don't know why, but no, probably
not. But they were Japanese and they didn't know any better in 1967.
Sure.
Powdered alcohol has been sold under the names like Sure Shot or Palcohol.
Because it's your friend.
2050.
Yeah.
So that's not new.
Right.
But it keeps getting better.
Right.
And that's always been the problem is you could do it, but it didn't really taste great. There were obviously health concerns and just, you know, the fact that it was changed in the powderization process. And so it didn't quite have the same taste and texture. Mm-hmm. But they've been getting better and better. And that's why you probably heard about the most recent one. It was, you know, like we swear this tastes like the real thing. Mm-hmm. So I love this idea that we'll shave off all these problems. And in fact, not only the problems with alcohol, forget that, but like you say, with cinnamon Coke, easy to put the cinnamon in there, but how do you make it Coke? How do you make it bubbly? How do you make it have the right flavor profile? I think they'll figure all of that stuff out. I think, put it this way, all of that stuff is figure outable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What we need is the motivation to have to do it. Right. And maybe the motivation to have to do it is colonization of other planets.
Right.
Water is heavy.
Yep.
But if you're like, hey, we have a way that you can have your whiskey and your Coke and your jasmine green tea. When you get to Mars, just pack up these powders.
Yep.
And then we figured out water on Mars. That's another part of my equation, I'm going to assume.
Yep.
So there's plenty of water there now because we slammed a comet into it or whatever. Then I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't think we're anywhere near. I mean, we're nowhere near replicators. But I always love to think of what half measures to the replicators might look like, and this to me seems a step in that direction. So, we'll see.
I mean, it's not the same technology, but just the fact that you can go to a movie theater now, and there's a machine that says we have 35 different flavors of soda. It's probably even more than that.
Oh, that would have blown my mind in 1985. Right? Oh my gosh, dude. Yep.
And that was technology that we theoretically could have done, but you couldn't make it work well in a retail setting until recently. Somebody cracked the code like, here's how you do it.
Yep. It's a piece of magic if you just look at it, you know, on face value. You look at that machine and go, how is that thing doing what it's doing? And how does it do it for enough people in a sustained way on a busy Saturday night? Like,
right.
I still don't actually know. Like
it still breaks sometimes. I think it just has tons of syrup packets in it, mm-hmm. for all the different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those flavors are created by combining syrup packets, right? So you can have the cherry caffeine-free Diet Coke because you've got the caffeine-free Diet Coke serum and the cherry serum, right?
Yep, yep.
So now everything can be cherry. That's easy.
Yeah.
And then it's just a matter of the touchscreen being able to activate the right gels in the right amount and combine it with the carbonated water as it comes out of the fountain, and boom, there you go.
The bummer is I dumped soda for good, and now that machine and I have a very adversarial relationship. If I see one,
because it doesn't have anything but soda in it.
Yeah, I see it and I just go, oh, man, I know it's got diet things. So I could do that, but I don't like any.
Oh, so you
things.
Haven't dumped the soda part. You dumped the sugar part.
The sugar part. Yeah, I should say that.
Oh, man. I never drink anything but diet soda.
Yeah. What do you like?
Go do it. Well, when I go to a movie, a lot of times what I like to do is I chose this example out of my own personal experience, diet cherry caffeine-free Coke.
That sounds great.
I get caffeine-free because I'm usually seeing the movie at like 8 at night and I don't want to stay up.
Yeah.
I get the diet because I don't want the sugar, because,
yeah.
Man, sugar and soda, that'll kill you. And then I get the cherry because you can never get diet caffeine free Coke as it is, pretty much. But to get cherry diet caffeine, I don't even think they bottle it.
Is the, the cherry,
you can never get otherwise.
Does the cherry inject sugar and we're just not being told? Or do we,
no.
you don't think
no,
so?
No, it's cherry flavoring. It's still diet.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? That is what I'm going to do. That magic machine and I have got a new lease on life.
That magic machine could be your best friend because it can give you all kinds of diet sodas.
I'm very excited.
It'll still rot your gut out. Don't get me wrong, but at least you won't gain weight.
At least you'll be a wasted away, but thin when you waste away.
Although they say if you drink too many diet, like sugar-free supplements, mm-hmm. that it makes your body hungrier because mm-hmm. your body's looking for the calories that are supposed to come with the sweet taste.
And it can't find it. That's interesting. Yeah. But if you're moderate like anything else, you'd probably be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now this. The proper use of that clip. It is the best thing of all time this week. And this is the thing where we just take a thing we're just loving right now. It's like the best thing this week. And
we're loving it.
For me, it's a thing I actually repeated on another show, but I think it's worth bringing up here. I've been playing Elder Scrolls Online, which is kind of my backup MMO when I'm not playing World of Warcraft. It's like I keep going back to it. There's something about it. I think what it is it's basically, they've polished that thing into what is basically an Elder Scrolls game that just happens to have people in it. It's not really an MMO in my mind. But it is. I mean, it's got, you know, multiplayer people and stuff like that. But it's very much like Skyrim-y, you know, Oblivion-style approach to the Elder Scrolls world. And I love tooling around in that world, and I like it a lot. Well, I happen to be fishing because I'm trying to get some fishing for cooking stuff I'm doing.
Oh, and you don't like the fishing.
I normally don't. And it's not great here either. It's a little more fun than the WoW one where you click on the bobber, but it's okay. But I'm out there fishing because I want to do this cooking thing. And there's a dude who at first I thought was an NPC, but then later realized it was an actual guy sitting next to this river, this little bog I was fishing in. And I thought I'd just say hi. So I did a little public hello chat thing. And he wrote back, oh, hello. And then we had the most interesting conversation about him, why he was there that night. He said that his dog had just passed away and he used to have his dog on his lap when he would play the game. And he used to just kind of love that. The dog would just sort of chill on his lap and curl up and he would play the game all night. And the dog would sort of stare at the screen while he played and had this like really close connection to his dog and you know, have related it to having, you know, being in this game.
So he wasn't an NPC.
No, he was a regular old player.
Okay. All right.
And I could tell, I mean, if you hover over him, you can tell who's who, but sure. First it just looked like a dude sitting there. Cause there's not a lot.
I was going to be impressed by the AI.
Yeah, it would be right. Super, super cool AI you got going there, Elder Scrolls. But anyway, we got talking and it was just this super sweet conversation that this was the promise. We were all promised that video games opening up to internet-connected worlds where we could all sit around and work together and talk together. And it's always been true that you can find that. It's just, it's been a while for me. That it's usually loud kids, you know, in Fortnite, or it's somebody saying something racially horrible in a game of Apex Legends, or, you know, whatever it is. You start to get a little jaded to that and expect the worst from people. And here I was in a complete happenstance, bumping into a guy and having just this meaningful human relationship conversation. And we added each other as friends and said, yeah, next time you're online, you know, we'll hop in, do some stuff together or whatever. Like it was really nice. So that was my favorite thing of all time this week. It was a neat little side thing that I didn't expect, didn't see coming, and cheered me up. So there's that. Tom,
that's the best. I love that story.
No, thanks.
Because you're right. Like that's the kind of thing you don't hear about enough. Which is, oh, I was playing this video game and I saw this person. Like, okay, here we go. Yeah. It's like, and he was really nice. Told me a story about his old dog. And like,
we're jaded, and it's too bad. And we're understandably jaded. I don't want to say that people are, you know, being artificially jaded. We've seen a lot of stuff in online interactions, and it's not always good. In fact, a lot of it's bad. So this was like a reminder, like, oh, right, this can totally happen. And boy, am I glad I said hi to this stranger. You know, like, it could have been dumb and he could have just said, F off, I'm fishing. You know, it could have been whatever. But instead, it was this meaningful thing. So anyway, sometimes you just have to go look for it. All right, what'd you find this week?
I've been reading the Sword and Laser pick for this month, Seven Blades in Black by Sam Sykes.
Ooh.
And I was enjoying it. It's weird with Sword and Laser. You know, on the one hand, we interview a lot of these authors, so it's all, you're always nervous when you're reading one from an author you know, like, gosh, I hope I like it. Then there's the sort of occupational hazard of doing a online book club for 10 years, because you'll enjoy stories, but it'll be a familiar kind of enjoyment. Like, oh, okay, it's this kind of story and I enjoy that and that's great. But there may be a little undercurrent of I don't know how to put it, but a lack of enthusiasm because you read so many books, right?
Right.
And it's never a criticism of the story, but it's like, oh yeah, this is a really good version of this kind of story. That's how I was feeling about Seven Blades in Black, up until a revelation. And of course, I won't spoil anything, but there is a revelation that turned the world upside down. And because it had been a good story up till then, I was invested enough in the characters and in the world that it blew my mind. I like gasped, my mouth fell open. It's been a while since a book did that to me. Wow. And I immediately texted Veronica, I'm like, how far into the book are you? And she's like, oh, I'm only this far. And I'm like, call me when you get this far. Because, and I won't say, I didn't even want to say, cause it's crazy. Cause I just want her to experience it the same way I did, because man, it's just a great reveal. And I'm sure that some people will read this book and be like, yeah, I saw that coming from page one, right? Like, mm-hmm. Okay, great. You also didn't enjoy The Crying Game either. Great for you.
Yeah.
But I did not see this coming so much, and the way it was revealed was just fantastic. And all in all, it's a great fantasy story about a kind of a rogue character. Her name is Sal Cacophony. She has a sentient pistol that is her major weapon. She also wields a sword, and she goes around as, she's called a vagrant in this world. She goes around trying to avoid both the Imperium and the Revolution. She's pretty much out for herself, but you can tell she's, you know, maybe not a heart of gold, but, you know, is not a bad person deep down. Mm. And she's got a love interest named Liette that you'll meet and get to know. And their relationship is fraught because she has this mission, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all book jacket stuff.
Yeah.
But man, it got real, real, real good earlier this week. And it was so much fun to be reading.
I am very interested. This sounds like my jam when it comes to fantasy novels. So.
Oh, I think, yeah. I think this is right up your alley, sure.
I'm going to get it. Amazon's got it for $11.99 on Kindle. I read most things by Kindle.
If you do audiobooks, folks, there's an audiobook for this as well, and it's very well read. It's female reader because it's female main character. She's got a British accent. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah, and she's she looks like a rad character. Reminds me, for some reason, I'm getting vibes from Best Served Cold, the what's his name, one of his,
oh, Joe Abercrombie.
Yeah, the Abercrombie book. It's like a side story.
As
in
a
that
matter
world.
Of fact, this is a very minor spoiler, okay? And when I say very minor, like, I'm going to tell you a catchphrase of the character. So if you don't want to even know a catchphrase of the character, let me know.
All right, I don't mind. Go.
Sal Cacophony will occasionally, in telling you the story, because it's told in most of the book, it's told from Sal's point of view, mm-hmm. in Sal's voice. She will say, yeah, sometimes she will say, now I can't remember it because I've got nine figures in my head, but she'll say, like, you know, they may say a lot of things about Sal Cacophony, but they will say X, Y, or Z. And it's very much emulating the, like, say what you will about Logan Nine Figures, say he's,
I'm in then, because I love that kind of writing. The Abercrombie books are my favorite. I need to read that new one too. I haven't done it yet, but oh man, that whole realm of fantasy writing is my favorite. I don't even know what to call it. It doesn't feel like a subgenre. It's just kind of an approach to the material.
I mean, Joe Abercrombie is often called grimdark. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of helped define that genre of grimdark. Seven Blades in Black isn't as grimdark because, I don't know, because it's not focusing on, there's grim things that happen, don't get me wrong. It's sure. not focusing on the grim as much as the characters.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting.
Well, I will definitely check it out. That's our favorite things this week, everybody. You should believe us when we say it's good. By the way, if you're looking for, that's probably the other reason I like ESO. ESO reminds me of of Abercrombie books. Like, it's that kind of fantasy. Yeah. It's a little dark, yeah, a little bit ruined, a little bit messed up. I like that.
It is. What does it say about me that when I saw in the lineup you put ESO story for a second, I was like, is that a Korean boy band? Or the EXO? That's a, never mind.
Because you're really into Korean pop, K-pop. You love it. And because of that, everything is colored by that. And that's fine. It's totally fine. No judgment here, Tom. No judgment here. No, hey, if you send us emails, we read them on the show too. CurrentGeek@gmail.com is the email address. You can also leave us voicemails at 801-471-0462. I have an email to read. This is from Belissa, or B-Alyssa.
B-Alyssa, yeah. She's a listener from back in the Buzz Out Loud days.
Oh, my gosh. Been around for a long time then. Hi, Scott and Tom. I was interested in your discussion on how budgets can limit creativity on a TV show. I think this came up with our most the Doogie Howser thing. It says, and I wanted to tell you a story about how a budget limitation resulted in more creative scene. I heard this on the official podcast for Breaking Bad. I'm sure you remember the scene where Jesse climbs onto a porta potty in an effort to get over a fence and get back the RV. This is all true. The original scene called for a dog to be inside the fence, a predictable trope, a junkyard dog, but there were no trained dogs in Albuquerque, and to get a dog and a trainer to come to LA was going to cost about $25,000. This is according to Vince Gilligan. So they tried to think of what else they could do. At the time, they were on location across the street from a company that rented porta potties, and they were all lined up just sitting there, and seeing them gave them the idea. First thought was for Jesse to climb on top and to have to tip it over, but the porta potty owner said they're bottom heavy and very hard to tip over. But falling into one might work just as well, and thus a classic TV episode was born. Thanks for the show, B-Alyssa. Yeah, no, I'm a gigantic believer and fan of necessity. What's the old phrase? Invention is the friend of necessity. What is it?
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Invention, there you go. This is the case of that. They don't want to do it because it's not in the budget. They have no other options to get the dog there. Their creative mind has to kick in and come up with a solution. That oftentimes is the best stuff you ever get out of anything. And I don't know why that is. It's because that extra energy was thrown behind it. They had to exercise their most creative sort of script gymnastics to get it where it needed to be. I don't know, but I really have always admired that, and I love that. I love that when that happens. And I don't know if it happens very much in big $400 million epic films or something. You know, they just kind of buy whatever they need. But I always love those stories where you're like, well, that was originally supposed to be this, but because we couldn't afford it, we did this.
Well, I don't even think it's always afford, right? Sometimes it's just wasn't possible, or it wasn't available, or the company that owned the land that we wanted to shoot it on wouldn't give us the permission to do it, right?
Like, right.
So I think even in the big big productions, you run into that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's really fun to see how those things turn out. So great example, B-Alyssa. Thank you for sending that in. And again, currentgeek@gmail.com if you would like to participate in emails. All right, next week, it's time for another Film Fest film. And it's one that I have all kinds of hot feelings for. for lots of reasons that aren't about the movie itself, but we'll get into that next week. That is The Dark Knight, 2008's epic Batman thriller, The Dark Knight. Oh, Tom, it's going to be good.
I'm Batman.
It's the only thing I hate about those three movies is his vocalization for Batman is terrible, but everything else is
one of the greatest movies of all time, yeah, according to the list that we consulted to create the Current Geek Film Festival. If you're like, oh, finally, they're just going to pick stuff they like. Yes, but also this is universally considered to be a great movie.
Yeah, even when you have conversations today about, oh, what's the best superhero movie? And a lot of people are super jazzed about Into the Spider-Verse or the way Endgame turned out, or, you know, there's a lot of Marvel stuff to talk about now. And you can talk about a lot of independent things that were very good that were based on comics originally. But The Dark Knight is always up there. If not number one, it's in the top three for most people. And if you've, you know, haven't seen it in a while, go remind yourself how freaking good it was. It is, in my mind, one of those examples of a perfect film. I think it's amazing. And I'm very excited to talk about it at length. So that's next week, right here on Current Geek, The Dark Knight from 2008, which was the second annual Nerdtacular. Side note there.
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah. That's where the Fat Batman came.
Fat Batman came from that. You're right. Yeah. And I got told by DC to please take my Fat Batman down, and I didn't. and they never did anything about it.
No, that's not Fat Batman. That's just me.
I just had a hunch that parody was okay because I wasn't actually selling the Batman image. I was just using it for tickets. And I had a feeling that they weren't going to follow through, and they didn't.
So. Well, I mean, they could have gone after you for marketing under their trademark if they really thought that there would be confusion.
It felt like a thing where they were like going after every small example they could with a cease and desist, but then that's it. They were just
throwing it out there to wipe out as many as they could.
Which I don't blame them. I really don't. But I don't think they do it today. Today's different. People want your cosplay and your drawings and your illustrations and your fandom. It's turned. It used to be a
times have changed.
They have unless you're Nintendo, they haven't changed at all. They still get mad.
No, I mean they've even changed a little for Nintendo, but not as much.
A little bit. It's a me, not changing very much.
It's a me, cease and desistio.
don't leave yet though, because when we're done here, Legal Geek swoops in and covers the recent appeals case, helping confirm the limits on the scope of design patents in the U.S. This is of interest to Tom, of course, with the old patent talk.
Yeah, right.
Also explains why a basket is not a chair and vice versa. If that's intriguing to you, then stick around and listen.
Thank goodness. Finally, someone can explain that.
Someone said it out loud. The bravery.
I keep trying to carry my apples in a chair and sit on a basket. People say, no, Tom, listen to Legal Geek. He'll explain this to you.
Of course. Tom Merritt, anything happening in your world that we should tell people about?
Indeed. I write all kinds of stuff. I've got a book on the way called Trigger, which is a sequel to my book Pilot X, about a time traveler who's kind of lost his purpose, and yet he will recover it in this book. I've also got a book I'm working on about an alternate Earth, and I've been posting excerpts from a book about a secret place that runs the world. You can find out details for all of that in my weekly email, freetomnewsletter.com.
Oh, that sounds great. As for me, I would recommend you check out my morning show, The Morning Stream. If you aren't already, maybe you should. It's a fun daily look at the world around us, stupid people and stupid news stories, and great guests. Like Tom, he comes on Wednesdays, talks about technology. It's a nice, big, diverse, happy family over there at The Morning Stream, which you can find at frogpants.com/TMS. All right, that's going to do it for us. Current Geek is our website, patreon.com/currentgeek for your support. And you can find Tom and I on Twitter, Ace Detect, and of course, I'm Scott Johnson. Show is Current Geek. For me, for Tom, for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review a recent Federal Circuit appeals case on design patents that confirmed just how far they can extend in the U.S. In the U.S., patents are offered on two types of innovations: utility patents for functional inventions, and design patents for ornamental and aesthetic designs of articles of manufacture. The easiest way to understand the difference is to provide the example of a table lamp, in which how the electricity functions to illuminate the bulb would be covered by utility patent, while the design defining how the lamp looks to consumers would be covered by design patent. Design patents are more like trade dress, and in most other countries, designs are registered like trademarks instead of examined for patentability. Design patents have been used a lot in recent years, especially by software companies to cover ornamental features in things like user interface designs. Perhaps most notable is the Apple v. Samsung conflict, which led to damage awards of billions of dollars based on the look of a phone user interface. As these companies began pushing the boundaries of how broad design patents can be, we come upon the current case that we discussed today. This case between Curver Luxembourg and Home Expressions is interesting because it involved a design patent interpretation in a scenario not previously opined upon in the courts. Curver filed a design patent entitled Furniture Part to cover an overlapping Y design to be used on furniture in 2011. The drawings did not show the design in use on furniture, just the design by itself. During prosecution, the Patent Office Examiner objected to the title based on being too vague. Curver amended the title and the claim of the design in response to refer to this pattern for a chair. Years later, Curver went to enforce this design patent against Home Expressions, which was using a substantially similar overlapping Y pattern on baskets. Home Expressions objected to this lawsuit, claiming that the design patent was limited to chairs, but as stated previously, chairs only shows up in the words of the patent, not in the drawings, and the drawings are usually what defines the claim scope of a design patent. The Federal Circuit confirmed the lower court decision in this case that the design patent was limited by the words to implementation on a chair, thereby not being able to cover the home expressions baskets. The court relied on 100 years of case precedent and patent office practice, enforcing design applications to be limited to designs as used on an article of manufacture, not just abstract two-dimensional designs. Because no guidance on the article of manufacture was given in the drawings, the court could turn to the words of the application and make them limiting in this case. Thus, design patents are confirmed to not extend to designs absent specific goods, imposing an important limit on how broad these patents can be. The bottom line is, design patents are an important tool for manufacturers to use in covering all aspects of their products, but just like utility patents, they cannot broadly extend to underlying abstract ideas and concepts. While the unusual fact pattern presented by this case may not be repeated again soon, this does provide guidance on how design patents have limits, which may define when other types of IP protection may be more appropriate for use to cover a product or invention. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.